You're on the road less traveled with Gary L. and Gigi's Boo on reallibertymedia.com, RLM Radio. Hello, everyone out there in radio land or internet land and RLM land or whatever land you perceive yourself to be. Hey, Gigi's Boo, how you doing?
Fair to middling. How about everybody in the chat room? How are y'all doing? This has been kind of a rocky 24 hours for me. I'm not myself, so I apologize. But anyway, it's good to see everybody tonight. It's good to be in the show.
Yeah, good to be here. Noticed pre-show that Grimner made the comment in the RLM chat room that it's funny how often the stream, which he's referring to, is the 24/7 audio stream that is constantly being sent out from Real Liberty Media. .com, RLM Radio. He says it's funny how often the stream is playing a replay of the show that will be coming on live. How interesting, the odd synchronicity of that. And I have to observe that I personally don't believe that there is any such thing as a coincidence or what people popularly refer to as coincidences. I mean, certainly events coincide. Perhaps the dynamics surrounding the coincidence of those events is something that lies a little outside of our general understanding. So anyway, hope everyone's doing well out there. And I have the chat room at reallibertymedia.com, front page. All you have to do is go to the page and sign in. And you're in the chat along with people like Grimner, who runs this place. Moose Girl, Kate Asmo, Betsy, Chalcedony, Chloe, Free and Slave, Graham Z, Ibidon, C, Java, Dr. JJ, Wanataco, Meister Brow, Rain, Rob Works, Trust No One, Woodman, Beetle, Behind the Woodshed, Circle, Colfax, Dakota, Dima, Echelon, Ferris or Ferris, I'm not sure which, Flash Nasty, Frumpy, Kozu, Moy, Pox Box, Poxify, Pox Phone, Pox Home, Pox a Home, we got all kinds of pox be on you kind of things. Pawnsaw, Skittle, and the Phantom. So it seems like a continually growing group of people here in the chat room at reallibertymedia.com. So there we are. You have that all that out of the way. So what's been going on, Gigi's Boo?
Nothing much. We've had excitement, lots of other things going on, but it's been a fairly good week. It really has. 24 hours has been kind of crazy, but that comes around here, down here in the South, they say. And it does. Hal, Gary's going to be sending you some pictures of Atticus. He did a dead dog line. It's so funny. We took pictures of him, and he's laying, and as I take his picture, it was like a dead dog. He even propped his leg up on the wall for us. Be looking for that.
Yeah. Yeah, we always have some funny pictures from Atticus, and had something of an unfortunate event I don't think we mentioned before, was the collapse of a china cabinet.
I think that started the whole rigmarole with me. We had china. I have china that belonged to great-grandmothers and grandmothers and great-aunts and great-great-aunts and great-great-grandmothers. But this particular china, Gary and I bought together because I liked the pattern. It was Royal Kent Bavarian Rose, and I had a great-great-aunt that left me the china. So we decided to add another set to it if we could find it. Oh, we really sacrificed to buy that china. And I ran upon a kind of a china cabinet that was glass shelves. Got it for steel. Really did. It was supposedly brand new. And during the delivery of it, one of the glass panels had broken, so they sold it. It's a $500 type deal, and they sold it to me for $50, and we thought it was really great. Gary and I put glass in it. And as I was putting our china that we bought together, we scrimped, we saved, we could get it, because I think we gave almost $600 for that china. I had it in there, putting it in, all of a sudden, everything in the china cabinet imploded. It didn't explode, it imploded. And I stood there, and there my china, my beautiful china, was broken. And I've not really been myself since that happened. It's not really fair, because Gary's been on the end of some of me not feeling so good, not wanting to talk. I apologize to him, but that really did something to me. Now, none of the old china was hurt. It was still old china that Gary and I had bought, but it was from somebody else. I got real upset, and I told Gary, I said, we're going to take this thing out of the house. I feel like it had, as us Southern people say, it had a haint or a spook on it, and I got it out of the house. I just told him, I said, get it out of this house, and we moved it. Told Gary, I thought I'd just go out there with a darn sledgehammer and bust it up and put it on the side of the road. Don't know yet what I'm going to do, but I don't think it ought to be passed on to anybody. I really do think there was some bad juju with it. Gary does, too. Gary thinks there was something bad with it.
Yeah, and Atticus, I think, thought there was something bad with it as well.
Oh, yeah. He likes to look at himself in the mirror anyway, and Hal's seen video of him doing that. But this particular, the other one, he just bark, look at himself and bark. But this one, he just seemed really unsettled about it. He just barked and just tried to hit the glass and the mirror and everything. And I told Gary, I said, he's acting a little different with this one. Of course, it was bigger. We thought that was what it was. Had more mirror in the back. The whole back was a solid mirror, and it was a huge thing. So we don't know, but Atticus didn't like it at all either. It's out of the house, and he settled down, and I think we've got some cleansing we need to do around here a little bit with some cedar.
How did Atticus react when it collapsed? You were right beside of it when it happened.
Yeah, I mean, he really barked and tried to attack it. He really thought that it had gotten me. And what is so strange, I was just right at the bottom getting the china to put in there. And when I did, I just, I can't tell you it was an audible voice or anything, but something said, move, 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 move. And any time that tells me that, I move. I've had two times in my life that's happened. And when that thing did that, he went crazy. He was trying to jump in it, and I was holding him because it broke a lot of glass. He was really upset about that. And so we kind of think it would be in our best interest just to pitch it on the side of the road. Yeah, good firewood. You're right, Graham. That would make good firewood. Hal said firewood with sage. Yeah, get that good stuff coming in. Take the evergreen, the cedar, and run the bad out and bring the good in with the sage. But yeah, he was really mad at that thing. Kept running over, checking me and making sure I was all right. It's bad. It was really scary for a little bit.
Yeah, so you really don't know, but sometimes your senses tell you things that you don't know otherwise. And certainly animals are very sensitive to things like that. So when you consider the fact that Atticus acted the way he did, it imploded. Kind of reminds me of the World Trade Center. Kind of imploded for reasons other than what might be obvious, for no particularly obvious structural reason.
And what we didn't say is that the exact panel that we put in there was the panel that broke again. That was the first thing that broke, was that side panel, and then all the glass came down, and it was just everywhere. It was scary.
Yeah, and no jet fuel either. Jet fuel has not been known to bring down china cabinet life. I don't know. It's just an interesting story. I thought we'd share it with you guys. And sometimes there's more interesting things that happen in life, and a lot of people just kind of gloss over them and mark them off as coincidence. As we talked about earlier. But I don't know. In this particular case, there was something else going on. Something else. Speaking of something else going on, I think Jeezy's Boo found a story. Do you have that one you want to share, or what do you want to share?
Sure. I wanted to talk a little bit tonight. I found a cute story. I might start with it first. About 16 insane quotes from children that actually got printed in newspapers. We all know kids say wonderful things. One was a note. It said, how would you make a marriage work? A little boy of age 10 said, tell your wife that she looks pretty, even if she looks like a truck. And somebody put in parentheses, he'll be married forever. The second one was the last action hero. A little boy saved his sister's life. And the quote, I can't read the article, but what he quoted is saying, I'd do it all over again. She's been a pain this week, though. The next one was, hell hath no fury. Never argue with children. A little girl was talking to her teacher about whales, and the teacher said it was physically impossible for a whale to swallow a human because even though it was a very large mammal, its throat was very small. The little girl stated that Jonah was swallowed by a whale. Irritated, the teacher said again that a whale could not swallow a human. It was physically impossible. Little girl said, "Well, when I get to heaven, I'll ask Jonah." And the teacher said, "What if Jonah went to hell?" And the little girl replied, "Then you can ask him." I love that one. They asked another child to describe the Christmas mornings. And he said, "On Christmas morning, we all get up and open up our stockings. Then we have to wait for Dad to take a poop. And then we open our presents. After that, we eat breakfast." Well, that's just what Christmas means to me. And this little fellow was in the fifth grade. They had some people to say, children to say, "What are you thankful for at Thanksgiving?" And this little girl said, "I'm thankful for all the dead people, because at least they tried." It's all about perspective. Something you wish you had but can't have. One man said a large yacht. Another man said millions and millions of dollars. And a girl that was 18 said, "I wish my parents were still alive." That makes you think.
Yep, it does.
Okay, I'll go with my other story. I've always been fascinated by the Bouviers. That was the family that Jackie Kennedy came from. More so than I have been with the Kennedys. I've liked to read about them and listen to the different things about them, about the curse or the cursed. I don't know that the Kennedys were ever cursed. I just think their daddy was notoriously evil and they had so many children that, you know, when you have large families, things happen in families. But this is about Jackie Kennedy's aunt and her first cousin, Edith Ewing Bouvier Beale, and her daughter, Edie Bouvier Beale. They were very lavish spenders back in the years before, I think, taxes became so great. They had a wonderful, beautiful estate called Gray Gardens, and it was in the Hamptons. Somebody did a documentary on it, and I saw it on TV, and it was the tale of their story, how they had gone from being very prominent to being very destitute. The mansion has been restored. If you'll go online, you can see it, and it's absolutely gorgeous. Little Edie only sold it. She said she'd let it rot completely down before she sold it to anybody that put a golf house or a country club or anything on it. She wanted somebody to get it to restore it to its former beauty, and that did happen. In the 25 years that they lived alone in Gray Gardens, Big Edie and her daughter Little Edie became more and more isolated, rarely leaving the property. Gradually, the once beautiful gardens deteriorated from lack of maintenance. Bushes and shrubs grew out of control, and vines covered the house. They began taking in stray cats. Some people believe they coexisted with as many as 75 cats. Now, the cats had control of the house and were allowed to use the bathroom anywhere they wanted to. Health inspectors found cat feces in nearly every room on the property, and in 1965 documentary called Gray Gardens, and I would advise you to be ready. It's shocking, but it is very informative. Big Edie laughed as a cat relieved itself behind a portrait of her as a young woman. When Ben Bradley brought Gray Gardens in 1979, he reportedly found 52 dead cats. The pair was also living with a number of possums and raccoons. As the bills ran out of the money, they became desperate and started eating cat food. When the New York Times journalist Gail Shelley visited Gray Gardens, she reported that Little Edie spooned cat food from a can, shaped it into a mound, and topped it with a lemon garnish. She winked at Shelley and said, "Mother's pate." When David and Albert Maysles began filming Gray Gardens in the early 1970s, the crew actually had to wear flea collars during the whole 6 weeks of the project due to an infestation of insects. Ellen Hoveed, a member of the documentary crew, recalled that there were so many holes in the ceilings, raccoons dropped through them into the halls of the home. The property was covered in garbage, including newspapers and piles of cans. They had no running water, and health investigators discovered human feces in one of the bedrooms. Ben Bradley and Sally Quinn brought Gray Gardens in 1979, and they reported the house was so rotted that if they touched a wall, it would move out 12 inches, as if it were on the hinge on the second floor. Quinn said that when she pressed down on a grand piano key, the piano collapsed entirely. On one of her visits, she said the inside the cat smell was so overpowering, the floor was part dirt, the ceiling was caving in, raccoons peered at me through the rafters, some 20 cats scurried as we entered each room. They were prospective buyers. Little Edie gave the couple a tour of the home after she invited Quinn and Bradley inside. The younger Edie took them to the living room, twirled, and said, "All it needs is just a little bit of paint." The Suffolk County Health Department visited Gray Gardens in 1971 to perform a health inspection after neighbors reported the Bills' living conditions. It was apparent the building violated numerous regulations. The living conditions were so deplorable, authorities threatened to evict the Bills if they didn't get Gray Gardens back up to code. The Bills called the investigation the most disgusting, atrocious thing ever to happen in America, denouncing the Hamptons as a mean, nasty Republican town. The incident made national headlines, and the former First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, Big Edie's niece and Little Edie's cousin stepped in. She gave them $25,000 for the cleanup. The home required 40 gallons of germicide to make it livable again. Now, it says that Big Edie feared if Little Edie married that she would have no one to care for her in her old age. Little Edie was a socialite on the road toward fame, but she dropped everything to move in with her mother in 1952. And Big Edie fell ill. Little Edie felt trapped by her mother and often lamented the fact that she wasn't able to move to a big city to pursue her acting career. In the 1975 documentary, Little Edie tells Big Edie repeatedly should have liked to move to New York or Paris, to which Big Edie responds, "You've had enough fun in your life." The younger Edie tells the documentarians, "She's been a subterranean prisoner for 20 years here." When Little Edie spoke to the New York magazine journalist Gail Sheely in the early 70s, she invited Sheely to a nearby beach to escape from mother. At the beach, Little Edie told Sheely that she tried to run away from the home 3 times. Now, why she didn't succeed, I don't know. The journalist reports that as a child, Little Edie was attached to mother's hand at all times, accompanying her everywhere, including luncheons. Big Edie took Little Edie out of school for 2 years due to a vague respiratory illness, and the pair traveled and went to the movies or the theater every day. Eva Beale, a relative of the pair, says, "I think it was a safe haven for her always to be with her mother. They had such a wonderful bond that nobody could break." Little Edie ended all her letters to her mother with the sign-off of, "With ladles and ladles of kisses, loves and hugs, your ever precious, ever loving, ever darling, and kissable Edes." The bond between Big Edie and Little Edie was so intense, Little Edie prioritized her love for her mother over romance when she was just 11 years old. She wrote in her diary, "I have 2 great loves in my life. First, I love my mother, which will always go on, never be forgotten nor forsaken. Most children think that mother's love is a thing taken for granted, isn't it? Second, my buzzing love for a boy, no mere crush, but a true, steady love." Now, Big Edie, before she was into squalor, she was a very wealthy child herself before she married Mr. Beale, and she was really into wanting to be an opera singer. Her father was an attorney and a judge who made his fortune on Wall Street. And her mother's side of the family became rich in the pulp and paper industry. She was a talented singer and pianist when she was just 10 years old. Some people have even labeled her a child prodigy. She was a socialite who attended a lot of parties. She married the attorney Flynn Beale in 1917, and the same year Little Edie was born. Shortly after Big Edie gave birth to 2 sons in 1920 and 22, the family moved to their estate, Gray Gardens, in the Hamptons. Mr. Beale worked for his father-in-law at Wall Street firm Bouvier, Caffey, and Beale. He survived the 1929 market crash, but eventually lost all his money. Big Eddie behaved in a way that Bill found very unbecoming. He wanted her to attend garden parties and maintain their social status, while she was more interested in the arts. They had memberships at Maidstone Country Club, and Big Eddie often shocked patrons with her operatic scene. Mr. Bill divorced her in the 40s, leaving her for a younger woman. He told his wife before they split not to let their daughter, little Edie, know about their financial situation. He wrote, "She will think we're at the poorhouse, and it'll rob all her joy." Big Edie received Gray Gardens in her and her husband's divorce settlement as a small amount of child support, but that money wasn't enough to sustain their formerly lavish lifestyle, and she struggled to maintain the property. Big Eddie relied on her father, Major Bouvier, for financial assistance. Bouvier disapproved of her lifestyle, and he told her to sell Gray Gardens and start pursuing her singing career. The final straw came for Bouvier when Big Eddie arrived at her son's wedding dressed as an opera star. Bouvier reduced Big Eddie's inheritance of his $825,000 estate to $65,000. She became depressed and could no longer afford to send money to Little Edie, who was living in New York at the time. Before Little Edie moved back to Gray Gardens to take care of her mother, she had a promising acting career. She was enrolled in Miss Porter's finishing school in Connecticut in 1934 and was a model for Macy's. She caught the attention of the New York Times during her debutante party in 1936. She appeared in fashion shows and nearly signed contracts with MGM and Paramount, and she claimed that famous Broadway producer Max Gordon wanted her to audition for a theater role. She was never able to try out before her big break. Her mother ran out of money, and Little Edie could not take care of herself. So her mother asked her daughter to move to Gray Gardens to care for her and her growing number of cats. In her youth, Little Edie reportedly dated a number of famous men, including Howard Hughes, John Kennedy's brother Joe Jr., and millionaire J. Paul Getty. And they say that he might have proposed to Little Edie, although her cousin John H. Davis warns that she had a very fertile imagination. The Secret Service was assigned to Gray Gardens after Jackie Kennedy became First Lady. And Little Edie told Secret Service agents that if Joe Kennedy Jr. hadn't died in World War II, she would probably have married him, and he would have become president instead of Jack, and she'd be the First Lady instead of Jackie. It was told in the Bouvier family that Edie was the beautiful one in the family. She was considered a catch in her time, and she talked this about John F. Kennedy. She said, "Jack never liked society girls. He only dated showgirls, and I tried to show him I'd broken with society. I was a dancer, but Jack never gave me a tumble." While Jackie's social status rose, Little Edie's fell, due in part to Flynn's Bill's determination that neither of the Edies should be in the public eye. Little Edie recounted a tale when she modeled for the clothing branch Bacharach, owned by Gordon Bacharach. When her father found out, he marched up Madison Avenue and put his fist right through the window. It's said that after she moved to Gray Gardens after that, a cousin of hers, John W. Davis, said he watched her climb a tree in the estate yard one summer afternoon, and he was shocked when she brandished a lighter and set her hair on fire. It's unclear why she made the sacrifice, but journalist Gail Sheely presumes it was an act of rebellion. They survived on $300 a month, and they sold off their heirlooms to pay the bills. The home was massive, and it was filled with beautiful, beautiful artwork and beautiful antiques. And so she would invite people in to shop, and then she would set a price. And they sold all of it for cash, including the Tiffany silver and jewelry. Little Edie kept a few of the valuables under her mattress for safekeeping. They made the documentary about them. And on a trip, Radswell, that was a cousin, she realized the Bills would make a fascinating documentary. She was unhappy with the decision, but they went ahead and did it. The 1970 film showed Big Eddie and Little Edie living in squalor among piles of trash and all these cats and possums and raccoons. Several scenes involved Little Edie trancing around in high heels dancing as she recalls her youth and former dreams of stardom. She had a way of wearing things on her head. She would tie scarves, even towels, a shirt, all kind of head wraps around her head, and they just thought it was because she wanted to make a fashion statement. But little did they know, in her 20s, she started losing her hair due to akathisia. Her fashion choices inspired designers such as Calvin Klein and Harper's Bazaar. Now, the mother always feared that somebody would evict them from Gray Gardens, and she had that fear until she passed away in 1975. She lived in the estate until her death 2 years later. She was so worried someone would try to evict her and little Edie from their home, she hardly ever left the property. She passed away in 77 from pneumonia. She reportedly told her daughter while she was dying at the hospital that she had said everything she needed to say in the documentary. So in 1979, little Edie sold the estate for $220,000 to Ben Bradley and Sally Quinn, who restored the house. She attempted a singing career, performing in several New York City cabarets. Gail Sheely reported that little Edie called her prior to moving to New York. She said Edie was very, very excited, and she sounded like she was a young girl again. She eventually moved to Florida, where she swam daily and survived on her savings. She passed away on January 14, 2002, in Bell Harbor, Florida, at the age of 84. She had atherosclerosis and died from either a heart attack or a stroke. But please watch that documentary, and you will see that even at the age that they did this documentary, she was a beautiful woman then. And you'll see pictures of her when she was young. She was stunning. And I found it very, very sad that this happened to these people. I'm very surprised that the Bouviers did not come in and try to help them more than what they were helped. But then again, you never know. They might have, and they refused it. We just don't know. But I found this very, very fascinating, and I hope y'all like my two little short stories, and I'm going to turn it over to Gary.
Yeah, very good. And as I was listening, I'm thinking that sounds a little bit more like a Norman Bates-style psychodrama than a documentary. But nonetheless, it sounds like a very interesting case study. And you're right. And there's something when you get into some of those families. There's, I don't know, for what, a screw loose or something. What do you think about that?
I don't know that they're screw loose. I just think that maybe they were a little on the eccentric side. I'm a little bit on the eccentric side, so I could see how they would kind of cloister themselves in and not get out and do anything because they didn't like people. And then again, you have to remember, they were afraid that their home was going to be taken from them. I think somebody asked in the chat room what was the name of the document. It's Gray Gardens.
Yeah, I dropped it in the chat.
Yeah, that's Gray Gardens. It's very, very interesting. I watched it, and it really broke my heart.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. And the Bouviers, of course, for those who don't know, that's the family of the JFK's first lady, Jacqueline Bouvier, later become Jacqueline Kennedy. And the Bouviers were on the same social ladder as the Kennedys, really.
Yeah, they were.
So when people need not to get that confused. So you're essentially talking about northern, what is that? There's a word for that. Can't think of what it is, but
northern aristocracy.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, something along those
lines. Or think they are.
Yeah. So it's interesting to see how those sorts of things turn out. And, of course, the legacies that seem to follow along behind these people. And it makes you wonder why. So anyway, thanks Gigi's Boo for going through all that, and a very interesting story. Just do a little bit of a transition here, though. Let's find out. People wonder, I don't know, I grew up using this, and Brenda, I think you grew up using this. You talk about supper, and, you know, who's coming for supper, who's coming for dinner. Well, a lot of people don't realize today that there is a distinction between those two terms and what the history behind all that is. Question here is, when you were growing up, were you called in for supper or for dinner? Which one is it? Some of that is geographically determined, really. There's some parts of the country that use the terms differently. A dinner, by the way, does not imply a time of day. It simply refers to what is the main meal of the day, and that's the history of it. Dinner was the main meal of the day, typically earlier in the day, right around what we now call lunchtime. And that all related to the fact that you had people working in agricultural settings, farms. And so during the middle of the day, you eat your biggest meal to help keep your fuel going to carry you through the rest of the day. The word dinner comes from Vulgar Latin that means to break one's fast. So what we call breakfast is actually related to the word for dinner. If you're not confused by now, we'll see if we can continue to get more confusing. And it says, while the word most closely related to breakfast in English, the meaning of dinner still influences how we use it. It has become the most popular word for the largest meal eaten during the day. Along with that, then we talk about supper, but where does that come from? Despite dinner's catch-all, supper comes from the specific old French word souper, which means the evening meal in the English language. Because the time of day is explicitly stated, it's related to the late afternoon or early evening. Supper is most often a light meal. It's something you didn't want to get confused, but why does it get so confusing? Well, it's not necessarily an American South or Midwestern tradition, but instead it's a farming family's trademark. Because the Southern and Midwestern states were heavily agricultural, supper was implicitly the lighter late evening meal, and dinner was the larger main meal. So for anyone who was really interested in that, it just caught my eye, because I know I've heard people use the terms interchangeably. And when I grew up, and I think Brenna grew up, there were very specific usages for those words. Anything you want to add to that, Gigi Spook?
Well, yeah. Around here, we called it supper. But if you got into society, they would say, we're giving you a dinner invitation. And that's what society called the evening meal here. They thought they were high society.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's interesting how these words morph and change over time. And let me switch these up a little bit. I had another tab set up, but let me back up. We were talking about kids earlier, and Brenna was doing a little bit of what some of the funny things kids say. Well, how about the kids that can't read a clock? Yeah, and schools in the United Kingdom are removing analog clocks and replacing them with digital ones because teachers say the students can't read them. I'm not sure what to make of that. As Malcolm Trobe from the Association of School and College Leaders Teachers Union said to adults, it might seem the second nature to use a standard clock face, but the current generation isn't as good as reading the traditional clock face as the older generation. So it's these little things, they're again kind of like dinner and supper, these little things that some of us have taken for granted all this time. But, you know, an analog watch face or analog clock face, and I've seen it myself, that a lot of the young kids, they look at an analog clock and they don't know how to read it. So that's how far we're moving ahead. And along those same lines, this one really grabbed me, Penn State University bans outdoor clubs from going outdoors. In the world of Twinkies and rainbows and Tide Pods, State College, Pennsylvania, this from the Associated Press, a near-century-old outdoor recreation club will now refrain from going outside because it's too dangerous out there in the wilderness, according to officials at Penn State. Originally founded in 1920, this Penn State Outing Club announced last week that the university will no longer allow the club to organize outdoor student-led trips starting next semester. The hiking, camping, and other outdoor-focused activities the student-led club has long engaged in are too risky. The university offices, student affairs and risk management determined. Oh, who will take care of the children? Who'll take care of the children? The decision was based on a two-month review that didn't include consultation with student leaders at any of the clubs deemed too risky. Two other outdoor recreation clubs, the spelunking Nittany Grotto Caving Club and the Nittany Divers Scuba Club, also have been directed to end trip offerings. I'll let you read the rest of that, and that's the direction we're going. You have to stay in your little virtual reality if you want to go outdoors, but don't really go outdoors. It's too dangerous. Oh, my, a bird may crap on your head. However, on a bright note, Sweden has banned mandatory vaccinations. They consider them to be serious health concerns. And they also say that mandatory vaccinations violate a citizen's constitutional rights to choose their own health care. The Swedish Riksdag, which means parliament, I guess, rejected 7 motions, rather, on May 10th that would have enshrined forced vaccination into law, stating it would violate our Swedish constitution if we introduce compulsory vaccinations. Now, here we are, home of the brave and land of the free and all that good stuff, but we don't seem to have a constitutional issue with mandatory vaccinations here, do we? Nah, it takes the Swedes to figure this out. How fun. Meanwhile, in Chicago, the drinking water, this reminds me, I think we talked about Detroit last week, and now Chicago, the drinking water is full of lead, a report says. It says toxic lead has been seeping into Chicago's drinking water, and the city is dragging its feet to fix the problem, according to an analysis published Thursday by the Chicago Tribune. Lead was found in 70% of the 2,797 homes the Tribune sampled across the city since January of 2016, and 3 in 10 had lead concentrations higher than 5 parts per billion, which is the Food and Drugs Administration's upper limit for lead in bottled water. Since the lead crisis in Flint, Michigan, Chicago has distributed thousands of free lead testing kits to its residents in an attempt to figure out how bad the problem was. But once the returns started coming in, the city buried them. The city hadn't updated the city-run website tracking the results of its own tests in more than 6 months, so the Tribune started asking questions. So an interesting story. You need to read that. It's from Vice News, dated the 13th of April. So, lead everywhere. And what about the cancer-linked weed killer? And guess what that is? Glyphosate. It's found in every food tested except broccoli, April 30th. A story from Anti-Media. The FDA even, has detected significant levels of glyphosate, a commonly used herbicide, in a wide variety of foods, but it's unlikely that the agency will release these findings to the public. According to internal documents that were obtained through FOIA by, of course, an English newspaper, The Guardian, and the advocacy organization U.S. Right to Know in January of last year, FDA chemist Richard Thompson wrote to colleagues, quote, "I have brought wheat crackers, granola cereal, and cornmeal from home, and there is a fair amount of glyphosate in all of them." Thompson, who is based in a regional laboratory in Arkansas, warned that the only food that didn't contain glyphosate appeared to be broccoli. His tests are part of the FDA's first-ever investigation into how widespread glyphosate, the main ingredient used in Roundup, by the way, has become in the U.S. food supply. As Newsweek noted in 2016, in the 1990s, Monsanto began introducing genetically modified crops that were resistant to herbicides such as Roundup Ready corn and soybeans. Since then, its use has skyrocketed, increasing 15-fold since 1996. In 1987, only 11 million pounds of the chemicals were used on the U.S. farms, but now nearly 300 million pounds of glyphosate are applied each year. And the story goes on and on about the characteristics of glyphosate, one of which you can remember is that it is a persistent element, which they denied for many years, saying it was not persistent. Yeah. Oh, I missed something Hal said in the chat room. Let me see. Somewhere down the line. I don't know. I lost it. Okay, I'll catch up with that later, Hal. I didn't catch that.
Northern aggression.
Oh, the war of northern aggression?
Mm-hmm.
What, how did we tie into that?
I think he's talking about the supper deal.
Oh, yeah, that's probably true. I'm surprised they don't call it something else, like a high Lincoln tea or something like that. Who knows? But anyway, the Pioneer, which apparently is an e-paper out of India, talks about a story on 17th April of 2018 that Monsanto has lost the right to patent seeds in India. Delhi High Court's rulings, which forbid Monsanto from stopping supplies to seed companies, is a boost to domestic seed companies and will curb the ability of multinationals to establish a seed monopoly. So the opponents of genetically modified crops received a boost when the Delhi High Court upheld the Indian Patent Act, which states that seeds and life forms cannot be patented. and the Protection of Plant Varieties and Farmers' Rights Act, which biotechnology multinationals have tried to undermine and ruled that the key plant genetic material cannot be patented. Here we are again. This is India. We have patents here in the United States, but we don't seem to feel the same way about that here, do we? Says the ruling is a boost to domestic seed companies that use Monsanto's gene to prepare BT cottonseeds for farmers and will seriously curb the ability of multinationals to establish a seed monopoly, which, as they state, is the goal of the GM industry. This could downsize the market for genetically modified seeds in India in any life form and pave the way for more environmentally sustainable, agriculture. And it talks about the experience they had with BT cotton. And there's actually a couple of documentaries out there, pretty shocking, if you want to learn more details about India's experience with BT cotton and the number of suicides that were precipitated by all that. Okay, here we go. Let's jump into 5G. 5G mobile trials. The government of IS Preview, the government's Department for Digital, Culture, and Media and Sports, has today, and this was March 10th, actually, named six projects that have won a slice of £25 million of public funding, to help trial the next generation of 5G-based mobile and fixed wireless broadband ISP technology at various locations across the United Kingdom. The investment is specifically needed to support phase one of the initial test beds and trials, which are being set up to help develop the country's 5G ecosystem. What? You know, you can't make this stuff up. 5G ecosystem of the future. The funding stems from a 2016 commitment by the government to invest £740 million from the National Productivity Investment Fund into digital infrastructure, which also aims to catalyze private investment in full fiber networks. And there are some sources you might want to dig into about that, which makes it real interesting. And it goes on and on, talks about that. The lead organization for this one, 5G Rural First, Rural Coverage and Dynamic Spectrum Access Testbed and Trial, the lead organization is Cisco. They got a £4.3 million grant. And lead partner, University of Strathclyde, will deliver test beds and trials to exploit 5G benefits for rural communities and industries like agriculture, broadcasting, and utilities to address the challenges and build the business case for 5G rural deployment. Then you have 5G Smart Tourism. The lead organization is the West of England Combined Authority, whoever that is, got a £5 million grant and will focus on delivering enhanced visual experiences for tourists using augmented reality and virtual reality in major attractions in Bath and Bristol. Worcestershire, there we go. 5G Consortium Testbed and Trials lead organization, Worcestershire County Council, got a £4.8 million grant, and they're going to, what do they want to do with this? They'll focus on ways to increase industrial productivity through preventative and assisted maintenance using robotics, big data analytics, and AR. I'm not sure what AR is, but anyway, over 5G. We'll also have a cybersecurity aspect with KinetiQ providing assurances of the security by design of 5G and Internet of Things technology. Entrepreneurs will have the opportunity to test 5G capabilities in a new commercial tech accelerator located in Malvern Hill Science Park. Liverpool, a lead organization, Sensor City, grant $3.5 million. Sensor City leads a consortium made up of public sector health suppliers, the NHS, university researchers, local SMEs, and leading UK 5G technology vendor. They will see high-value technologies, including low-cost, open-source 5G networks, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, and Internet of Things deployed across deprived communities and Liverpool City Region testbed, and allegedly to reduce the digital divide while measuring the impact on patient monitoring. While measuring the impact on patient monitoring and support, management of loneliness in older adults, aid to independence living in home, and the facilitation of communication between hospitals and the community. So let's just cut it right there, because there are a few more things you might be interested in looking at. These are the rationalizations and justifications for the 5G rollout in the UK. So for those who are interested, you might want to check it out, especially since, coincidentally, on the 2nd of May 2018, The Telegraph released a story talking about the mobile phone cancer warning as malignant brain tumors double. Fresh fears have been raised over the role of mobile phones in brain cancer after new evidence revealed rates of malignant types of tumors have doubled in the past two decades. Charities and scientists have called on the government to heed long-standing warnings about the dangers of radiation after a fresh analysis revealed a more alarming trend in cancers than previously thought. And it talks about the study that's found in the Journal of Public Health and Environment. How interesting this is. They analyzed 79,241 malignant brain tumors over 21 years, finding that cases of GBM in England have increased from around 1,250 a year in 1995 to just under 3,000 now. There's your 5G rationalization right there. How interesting. Now, coinciding with this, in my opinion, in fact, I have a working hypothesis that deals with nano aluminum and 5G, but we'll get into more of that probably at a later date, because I'm still examining some of the research that's already been done with that. Kind of shocking, actually. But the Children's Medical Safety Research Institute revealed that they discovered a shockingly high level of aluminum in brains of individuals with autism, and they're suggesting it's linked to the autism-containing vaccines. And this was actually from 2017, end of the year, November. Study shows evidence of inflammatory cells loaded with aluminum crossing the blood-brain barrier and meningeal membranes. And here we go, out of the UK, again. A new study published by the Journal of Trace Elements and Medicine and Biology provides the strongest indication yet that aluminum is an etiological agent in autism spectrum disorder, according to researchers at Keele University in England. Something else you probably want to read. Well, what about aluminum in water? You always look for evidence when you're trying to look at sources for things. Now, we have pretty good evidence that there's aluminum in vaccines, in certain vaccines, not all, in certain vaccines, and that aluminum can cross the blood-brain barrier. But what about other sources of aluminum? Well, if we can find it in your water, it's coming from somewhere. In this Skillings and Son Incorporated article, and they label themselves as bringing water well technology to a whole new level, it says water contamination, the health effects of metals in well water. And it goes on into a lot of different metals like cobalt, copper, iron, selenium, zinc, and how those are actually important. But they talk about contamination in water. How's it get there? And here are some of the health effects that they list of ingesting metals. And let's just look at aluminum. The most common metal in Earth's crust is likely to be present at some level in most groundwater. Now, as far as I know, industrial aluminum comes from bauxite ore, but I don't know. Let's just keep on reading here. The possible link between aluminum toxicity and nervous disorders is currently under study. How interesting that is. And it goes and talk about how to treat your water, but how much aluminum is actually showing up in your water. And there are people out there who might be listening who have had their own tests done and have seen shocking levels of aluminum in their water supplies. They've had independent tests done. I've seen them. And I will not share them because I think it's up to the individual who had the test, private test done to do that. So here's an article, though. Aluminum, barium, and strontium, the new Manhattan Project. And it gets into the chemtrail thing. It's a very controversial. This is from Activist Post, and it's from 2015. But what's important about all this, as you scroll down through the article, talks about all the different patents that have been applied for. This is back as far as the 60s that have been applied for, at least applied for, and many granted. And, for example, 1962 U.S. patent metallic composition for production of hygroscopic smoke. Describes how aluminum, barium, and strontium may be used as an ingredient in, quote, a composition which produces hygroscopic smoke for use in influencing the weather, end quote. Very interesting stuff. But then you get to the coup de grace, and I just tripped over this today, actually, and we're right at the end of the show, but we'll have a little extra time because usually I edit out about 10 minutes of audible artifacts. But anyway, from the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry, from 2010, this is a study from 2010, assessing the fate and effects of nano aluminum oxide, and the terrestrial earthworm. So they're doing a study here. Why are they doing this study? Because they say in the abstract that nano-sized aluminum is currently being used by the military and commercial industries in many applications, including coatings, thermites, and propellants. Due to the potential for wide dispersal in soil systems, rather, we chose to investigate the fate and effects of nano-sized aluminum oxide, the oxidized form of nano-aluminum, in a terrestrial organism. And goes on to talk about all of that, what they discovered. And their results say, in the abstract, the results of the present study indicate that nano-sized aluminum oxide may impact reproduction and behavior of the earthworm that they studied, although at high levels unlikely to be found in the environment. So why would they study this? And it goes, it's a long, involved study with how they did, how, you know, as any study goes, shows how they conducted it. So something to consider. Now, what's a teaser on the hypothesis as we close out here? Well, I've actually found research that shows the effects of when you bathe, I say a cloud, but a mass of nano aluminum particles, when you bathe it in millimeter wave radio waves. Aluminum is a dielectric. So as a dielectric, it has capacitance properties. And capacitance means it has the ability to store and release at determined intervals electrical charge. So just think about it for a moment. If you have the edge of a millimeter wave penetrating your skull, which has nano aluminum particles all throughout, and it can induce a capacitance within the mass of particles, which the study showed that they could do that. It didn't have to go completely through. It only had to influence just the outer edge in order to induce a mass response or capacitive response. So long story short, in simple language, you're actually causing a sparking event. A sparking event is occurring within the neurons that are affected by this nano aluminum. And this is the hypothesis I'm working with right now. It's certainly far from being completely fleshed out, but I think anyone who has been paying attention to this subject will see where I'm going with this. It's a very fascinating thing to see all the bits and pieces of the puzzle are out there, hidden in plain view, but they're there if you want to find them. Gigi Spoo, what else you got to say before we take off? Where'd Gigi Spoo go? Let's see, I've got a note here. Okay, she had to take off, I'm sorry. Oh, wait a minute, let me look. Yep, she had to step away. Thanks for joining us tonight on The Road Less Traveled with Gary L. and Gigi's Boo on reallibertymedia.com. Hope you enjoyed the show. A little bit rickety-rackety scattered, but I'll continue to work on that hypothesis there. We'll see what we got. Anyway, take care, and we'll catch you next week here on The Road Less Traveled. Bye-bye.